Our cold case initiative started back in 2006, and we work with the Department of Justice to try to go back in time and either reopen or initiate racially charged murders that happened before 1969. And we have, like I said, about 106 cases. Not all of them are still pending. There's quite a few that are still active. And what we've done is we've tried to push out to the media and to the public our request for help and for assistance to try to get the public to come forward, especially those people who may be witnesses, who may have information from years ago, to try to come forward to bring a measure of justice to the victims and their families.
And so, when does a case transfer from being active to cold? What makes it chill?
That's a very good question. I think some of our cases never, I guess, became cold. I guess we just use that phrase to sort of group them all into one category. But some of them never, I think, became chilled, as you say. I think some of them remained active and remained pending because there were either local law enforcement that were still looking into it, even private citizens. We've had documentary filmmakers from Canada and from the United States. We've had academicians and historians that have gone back and have continued to keep a case alive, and even family members. We have quite a number of surviving victims that have kept their mothers and fathers' memories alive and wouldn't allow the case to go cold. And I think we owe it to them to keep them pending and keep them active.
And is the information that you get from witnesses that have witnessed criminal behavior or criminal activity from years past, is it still usable? I mean, are their memories still, you know, good? Do they retrieve information accurately, or is that a problem too?
That's a very good question. I know that for a lot of law enforcement agents and officers, a lot of times witness memory is not the best evidence. Usually we try to find something in addition to that. But we have found that because these crimes and these murders were so heinous and so terrible back in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, the people who witnessed it, their memories have remained very true and very constant. And a lot of times, a lot of our witnesses were children at the time of the crime, and we've even found that they made notes at the time, or they told a sibling about what just happened, or they told their neighbor, and that memory stayed alive because they recounted it at the time. And so when they told it to us years later, it was the same story that they had told, you know, back in 1950. So a lot of the time, the witness accounts have remained very accurate.
We're talking this morning to Supervisory Special Agent Cynthia Deedle about some of the cold cases that the FBI is looking into.
And I was wondering, you mentioned that these are racially charged cases. What are most of the victims, therefore, African-American in the majority of the cases or in all of the cases?
They are. There is, we have found some victims that are Hispanic. We do have a case in San Antonio that we're trying to get some help with. And I should mention that a list of our cases where we do need the public's assistance is on our website, which is FBI.gov, and I would encourage your listeners to go to the website and take a look at the list of cases. But like you said, most of them are African-American victims, and what we have found, actually, is that some of the names on the list where maybe it was reported that there was a racially charged murder back in the 1940s or 50s or 60s, through our investigation, that turned out not to be true. And we have found that some of these victims died as a result of an accident or an accidental drowning, for instance, or a car accident. But there was no crime involved. And we've actually been able to go back and tell the families of these, what we thought were victims of these racially charged crimes, that their father or their mother or their uncle did not die as a result of a racially charged hate crime, that they died as a result of an accident. So we've been able to at least, you know, go back and tell the truth to the families, which I think is a good thing.
But in many cases, there might have been, especially in the 40s and 50s, especially in the South, there might have been a lot of fear on both the part of African Americans and white citizens to go to the law enforcement authorities, to go to the FBI. And so I wonder if that fear kind of became a habit that persisted long after the cause of it may have disappeared, and do you find that there's sometimes like a psychological breakthrough that people say, you know what, I've got to tell this story.
That has happened, and there's a great case that we're still working on, which is listed on our website. It's two African-American couples that were murdered on the Moores Ford Bridge just south of Atlanta, Georgia. And this happened in 1947. And it was just a brutal murder of these two couples. And we're now actively investigating that incident. And we have found that it's not just African Americans in that community, but it's also the Caucasian citizens who, even in 1947 and in 2009, are still extremely fearful to come forward and talk to FBI agents who go to these communities and really beg for assistance and beg for their help in these cases. But you're right, we've had private citizens and other witnesses who have talked to us to try to get something off their chest. They're getting older in years, and I think they want to probably cleanse their spirit, and they want to talk to us about what happened. So we have found success by just going down and really trying to communicate our commitment to solving these cases, the reason that we're doing this, and to bring some type of justice to the victims.
So was there a backlog of cases because there was such prejudice at the time? People really didn't want to investigate, or there was some sort of racial bias in the investigation process that caused these cases to go cold, or people were fearful because of retribution from people in the community that just had a racial bias?
Yes to everything you just asked.
Yes, okay.
I think as demonstrated in the movie Mississippi Burning with Gene Hackman, it's a great movie that sort of brings to light some of these issues. What we have found is that many of the perpetrators, the subjects, were either active law enforcement officers at the time of the incident, they were involved in the incident, or they were possibly in the Klan, which made it even more difficult for witnesses to come forward and try to challenge these people because they were the local sheriff or they were a local Klan leader, and the public was extremely fearful to come forward and to challenge them and to try to make them investigate something that they may have been a part of. So, yes, it's very difficult to break through those barriers and those stereotypes and go back in time, even now.
What I wanted to ask, too, Ms. Deedle, is how much role does the forensics part of this? I mean, again, earlier Jane mentioned TV programs, and they always have clues. But in murders that happened in the 40s, 50s, even the 60s, does any of that still come into play, or is it all pretty much witnesses?
We still have forensic evidence that we always try to recover. So, for example, exactly what you would see in CSI and on television shows where we would love to get the murder weapon. And a lot of times that is still very much in the picture. That still could be a weapon that has been passed down in the subject's family, and it still could absolutely be something that we can recover. Also, ballistic evidence, if there was a shotgun blast that happened in the 60s as part of this crime, a lot of times that local law enforcement department back in that time period kept that evidence somewhere in their police department or in their crime lab, and we can issue a subpoena and try to get that evidence recovered and then use that as part of our investigation and part of our case. So it still does play quite an active role in our cases in addition to the witnesses.
Of course, in recent years, DNA has come into so much crime investigation. In fact, it's exonerated some people as well as convicted. Has DNA been added to the mix as you research some of these cold cases?
I don't know of any of our cold cases which have evidence that has been submitted to our lab for DNA analysis, but that's always a possibility, and that's always something that is a tool that we would prefer to use because it's so reliable as a piece of evidence. So I don't know of any that are currently being tested for DNA, but that is absolutely something that we'd love to do.
Now, of course, as you investigate these, there must be a lot of cooperation that goes on with the Justice Department because they're the ones that have to prosecute the cases. Have you found that they're pretty receptive to this whole plan of trying to get to the bottom of these 106 racially charged murders before 1969?
I don't know that I could ask for better partners than the ones in the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division. They are passionate and committed and enthusiastic to helping us not just with the prosecution of these cases, but also with the investigation. I talk to them on a daily basis about our cold case initiative and about the status of our more active cases. They are a phenomenal resource. They are a very beneficial and effective partner to not only me as the unit chief, but also to the FBI agents in the field. They're phenomenal.
We're talking with Cynthia Deedle. She is a supervisory special agent of the FBI, chief of the Civil Rights Unit. And I wanted to know, too, from a personal standpoint, this has become kind of your life's work, at least right now, your opus in trying to solve these cases. Are there any that stand out in your mind when you think about it at night or when you're not on the job and that kind of drive you to keep investigating and trying to get to the bottom of these? Any particular cases?
You know, myself and some staff members were in Jackson, Mississippi last week, and we spent an enormous amount of time with the agents in Jackson, and there are quite a number of them, and their executive management and the FBI in Jackson, reviewing each of their cold cases. And they have the bulk of the 106 cases in that division. And there are many cases, especially in Mississippi, that it is a passion for me when I find those few cases where the FBI and the Department of Justice would have jurisdiction. And it's very rare. We don't have jurisdiction a lot of times, but if there is an allegation of kidnapping or if the subject transported the victim across a state line and committed the murder, or if there was a use of an explosive device, the FBI and the Department of Justice can now prosecute that on a federal level. So there are a few cases where that those statutes may come into play, and I can think of one of them involving the Moore couple, and they, Harry and Harriet Moore, and it's, they're also listed on our website, and it's a case that we are investigating. And they were killed as a result of an explosion from a bomb that was placed underneath their home. And because, again, there is...
This is in Jackson, Mississippi.
I believe this actually was in Florida.
Oh,
but
I'm sorry.
That's okay. There, because there is this allegation of the use of an explosive device, this is something that the FBI could be more actively involved in than just assisting local law enforcement. And there's other cases I can think of, too, where the victim was transported across a state line. There was this successful James Ford Seal prosecution in Mississippi back in 2007, where the two victims were transported across the state line before they were murdered. And it's those cases where I know the FBI could really bring a measure of justice to the victims and to the victims' families, where I do get a lot more committed and more enthusiastic with those cases. But it has. It's become my passion and my work in the FBI, and it's something that I work on every single day. And I believe that the FBI owes it to the public and also to the victims and their families, and I'm very proud to be able to do this.
And maybe just a few statistics. How many people are in your unit? How many people are devoted to this particular cold case investigations? Is it full-time for you?
It's full-time. It feels like it's full-time when I end up working on it over the weekend, but there are dozens of agents across the country that are actively pursuing cold cases, and there are dozens of agents across the country that work on other civil rights investigations in their own divisions, whether that be in Los Angeles or New York or Seattle, whatever that is. So, and there are also, I have staff members in the civil rights unit that are dedicated full time to the cold case initiative and to monitoring each and every investigation and to ensure that when we're finished, whenever that would be, that we have done absolutely everything possible to investigate this and to identify the subjects if we can and bring those subjects to justice. So there are dozens of FBI agents and supervisors and analysts that are committed to this effort.
Well, maybe we shouldn't call it cold case, maybe old case, because they are old, but it sounds like if you're on it, it's not cold at all.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because I don't think they're cold and chilled either. I think they're very active and very alive. And like I said, I'm very proud to be involved in it.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us, and we wish you all the luck in prosecuting these and closing all 106 of them.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.